So I would like to welcome everyone to our first discussion session at the basically Tattoo Network in High Energy Physics meeting. We're very happy to have Gifre Vidal, Ignacio Sirac, and Brian Swingle, who kindly agreed to participate as panelists. My name is Michael Heller. I'm going to be basically the host of this session. The idea that we had as organizers to go ahead would be to ask Gifre, Ignacio, and Brian to speak each for about 5 minutes and present cutting edge status, or like basically the current status of the respective fields, followed by nine questions that we selected from the responses that we got from the participants when registering, and then opening up for a free discussion with questions from the audience. So without further ado, let's start with Gifre, who prepared some slides to talk about continuous versus discrete tattoo networks.
Very good. Thanks, Michael. So let me start by congratulating the organizers. This workshop is really great. I had never woken up at 5 a.m. every morning to attend talks, but they are really worth it. Let's see. This was a bit of a tricky situation. I was asked if I wanted to submit a question, and then I said, yeah, let's talk about, my question was about continuous versus discrete tensor networks for field theories. And the next thing I know is that I'm being asked to answer the question myself. So I'll do my best, but this is, so in this first 5 minutes, what I want to do is to remind you the bigger picture when it comes to tensor networks on the lattice and in the continuum. And of course, I cannot summarize the whole, all the developments. So instead I'll focus on a couple of key issues. So the first one is that we're talking about wave functions, whether we are in the continuum or on the lattice. And if you want to, in the continuum, I should say wave functionals, but I'm just not going to do that here. I'm just going to refer to them as wave functions. And the first issue that I would like to focus on is that these wave functions are active or non-trivial, typically in a range of scales. So there is some, so I'm going to use Z here to denote scale. And we'll have some smallest or UV scale. When I say smallest, I'm thinking in real space, so a shorter distance scale, which typically will be maybe on the lattice would be our lattice spacing, or in the continuum, there will be also some short distance short distance cutoff. So we'll have that our wave functions are non-trivial from this small distance all the way to some largest distance, longest distance in the system, which we will assume typically to be some correlation length, perhaps due to a mass gap. Very good. So, and then what's interesting here is we'll ask the question of what's happening, or we'll investigate properties that occur in this scale, the scale span of our wave function. So going from the UV cutoff all the way to the IR cutoff. And so let's start with the lattice. On the lattice, what we're going to have, or what I want to do, I'm going to restrict my attention to one dimensions, one special dimension. I want to look at all the sides of my lattice. I want to take a cut, and then we're considering tensor networks to represent wave functions. So we're going to look at the structure of entanglement in this wave function. And what we typically see is that there are contributions starting from the shortest length scale all the way to the longest length scale in the system. Right, so from the shortest length scale on the lattice is given by the lattice spacing. And again, the longest length scale is going to be given by the correlation length. And so what we have basically is that the entropy that we are dealing with in this case, the entanglement entropy across this cut, is given by the logarithm of the ratio between the longest length scale and the shortest one. And that's just given by this scale span. Okay. So that's on the lattice, and then we have MPS. In the MPS, what we attempt to do is to describe the wave function in terms of this one-dimensional array of tensors. And what we know then is that if we cut the system in between left and right somewhere, then there is a single bond index that is in charge of accounting for all the entanglement that we've seen, where the entanglement corresponds to different length scales in the system. We have a single bond index, and this bond index then has a dimension that should grow exponentially in this scale span. All right, so that would be for the MPS. And of course, I'm talking about this so that we can jump to the continuous MPS in a minute. And you also all know that in the case of Meta, we have a different way of organizing the tensors into a tensor network where there's an additional direction which corresponds precisely to scale in such a way that now if we make a cut left to right, what we find is that there is a different tensor in charge of correlating left and right for each length scale that is relevant in this wave function. Okay, so what we have then is that instead of having a relation between the bond dimension of the MPS, as we saw before, and the scale span, now the relation is between the scale span and the number of layers in the tensor network. Okay, very good. So with that, let's jump into the continuum. And the continuum actually is not so different. And that's why I spent a minute talking about the lattice. In the continuum, now we don't have this wearing one dimension again. This black line here represents space. And I've blocked space again, starting with some small size and making it bigger and bigger and bigger. And for the purpose of this discussion, what we have again is that if there is a small length scale and a large length scale attached to this wave functional or wave function for the quantum field, then the entropy again is proportional to this scale span as we had before. But now we have to distinguish two situations. If we have a relativistic quantum field theory, where at short distance, let's say it's a bosonic field theory, and at short distances we have that the Hamiltonian is dominated by the kinetic term, what we're going to find is that there is no length scale, no short distance length scale. What that means, for instance, is that if you look at the two-point correlator, where r is the distance between the two insertions that we're looking at, then at short distances we'll see some power law divergence. There is no specific length scale at which there is a change of behavior. And what that means is that this picture is not going to be correct because there will be contributions to entanglement coming from arbitrarily small distances. Okay, that means A goes to zero and the scale span becomes infinite and the entropy as well. So what we do usually in these situations is we just artificially introduce a cutoff, so some finite distance A that regularizes the entropy, and we have again a situation very similar to the one we would have on the lattice. That's for relativistic quantum field theories with no short distance scale. For non-relativistic quantum field theories, say the kinetic term written in terms of this creation or annihilation operator, now in this case, what we have, if we re-express the field in terms of phi and pi, the original bosonic field and its momentum conjugate, then in doing that, we have to introduce a length scale right there, okay? And if the Hamiltonian is expressed at short distances in terms of a non-relativistic kinetic term, then we automatically have a length scale in the system. It's not a lattice spacing, but it's another length scale that appears there. And in particular, if you look at correlators that may behave as a power law maybe or so at long distances, at short distances, they will suddenly decide, okay, after for distances smaller than A, action is over, and instead of diverging, the correlator will go to some constant, okay? And the picture with entanglement is what you would expect, that it's suddenly regularized. So this length scale that you introduced in the Hamiltonian level is the one that regularizes your entanglement entropy. All right, so finally, why tensor networks in the continuum? So that's back 2010. Frank Verstraete and Ignacio Sirac introduced the continuous matrix product states. What they did not do is, I mean, the matrix product states are an amazing contribution, which has been very useful. They did not provide a useful picture for them, and that's, or at least they couldn't find it. And so that forced me into drawing this really crappy representation of the continuous matrix product state, where there is a bond dimension up here, and this is my way of saying there is no discretization at the level of tensor, so a continuous figure. Now, if we cut the matrix product state this tensor network, this continuous tensor network between left and right, again, we find that this only cuts the bond index at one point, one bond index. And as in on the lattice, what we find is that in the continuum also, the bond dimension is in charge of taking care of all the correlations between left and right. And so the bond dimension has to grow exponentially in the scale span. And for a non-relativistic quantum field theory, that's totally fine because, as we mentioned a moment ago, there is a UV scale in the theory, built in the theory. And so CMPS works out of the box. And all you need to make sure is that the bond dimension of the CMPS is large enough to account for all the correlations from the UV scale all the way to the IR scale. If instead you try to apply it to a relativistic quantum field theory, what happens in that case is that there is no UV cutoff in principle. So in principle, a finite bond dimension would not be enough. But what you can always do is artificially introduce a UV cutoff, and then you are in business again. Okay? So that's one aspect of it. And then much later, continuous meta was also introduced by Yuto Hagemann, Tobias Osborne, Henry Verschilde, and Frank Verstraeten in 2011. And again, that's the best picture I could think of. And in this case, what you have again is that there is some evolution in scale that is proportional precisely to the scale span of the wave function. And so again, the different contributions to entanglement coming from different length scales are contributed at different places in this continuous tensor network. And while continuous MPS is today a very useful computational tool, in the case of continuous meta, which was presented in full generality, both for the interacting and non-interacting case as a formalism in the original paper, what we have is a much better understanding of the non-interacting case for non-interacting quantum field theories, whereas the interacting quantum field theories is still a work in progress. How do we apply this general formalism for actual computations? And I'll talk more about this later on, but so let me continue for now, finish this summary with mentioning a couple of things about the non-interacting quantum field theory. For the non-relativistic free quantum field theories, CMERA can actually be seen to be able to represent exactly the ground state of some realistic Hamiltonians, local Hamiltonians. And then for the relativistic case, you just have to take the limit of delta z going to infinity, and you get also an exact representation. So what you can see is that both the continuous MPS and continuous meta are very useful representations of wave functions in the continuum. That finishes my summary.
Okay, fantastic, Yifra. Thank you very much. The time for questions will be later, of course. So let us move now to Ignacio, who's going to tell us about lattice gauge theories with tensor networks.
Yeah, hello, everybody. It's a great pleasure to be here. And so I don't have transparency, so I just tell a little bit about what I have in mind about lattice gauge theories and tensor networks, and in particular from the more practical part. So the first thing that I have to say is that actually, it happened very early that some people realized that tensor network could be used for lattice gauge theories. And in fact, at that time, they were not called, the field was not called tensor network, but it was more like VMRG. And so there were early papers at the beginning of the 2000s that applied VMRG methods to study one-dimension lattice gauge theories. And even they did the limit to the continuum, and they obtained very good results. So they computed things like ground state energies, but also the mass spectrum of the vector and the scalar excitations and so on. So then I think that so the field was sleeping for some years, and then it was revived in 2000, 2009, 2010, where there were several papers that started using again matrix Pollack states, now with all its power, not only to study ground states, but also to study excitations and to study the time dynamics, finite temperatures, and so on. And later on, so this was advanced and starting thinking about higher dimensions and how to encode gauge theories in tensor networks and so on. So what I'm going to do in these 3 minutes that I have left is to tell a little bit the state of the art now, as far as I know. So I have to say that there are many participants in this workshop that probably have a better knowledge about the state of the art of tensor network lattice gauge theory. So I hope that they correct me during the question session. But anyway, so I'll say what I know. So let me first start with 1D systems, so 1+1 systems. And so there, I think that for T equals zero, the situation for zero temperature situation is under control. So people have done calculations with discrete tensor networks with matrix Pollack states, computed ground state, excitations, as I mentioned, and I think that this is the method of choice at the moment for one-dimensional systems. You can go to the continuum, so you can take the limit to the continuum, and so everything works very well. You can take problems that have sign problem for Monte Carlo and solve with matrix Pollack state, and you don't see any problem related to the sign. So for zero temperature, I think that the situation actually is very, very well established, and there is no problem. There have been calculations also with continuous matrix Pollack states, and I mean, typically much harder to minimize the energy, so to find what is the ground state. But still, I think that in the last couple of years, there are very good results. Now, the next thing is at finite temperature. So the finite temperature, I think that is also very well under control. There are many MPS methods for finite temperature that can be applied to lattice gauge theories in 1+1 dimension. Also, one can take the continuum limit and everything. I mean, you can compare with exactly solvable models and everything matches very well. So I think that the situation is also very much under control. Now, where the situation in one dimension is not so keen is in studying the dynamics. So there have been computations both for discrete and continuous matrix Pollack states for dynamics, but this only works for short times. And we know that very well. I mean, the reason is that if you have some kind of quenching, then the entanglement grows very much. The areal is violated. And with ansatz like tensor networks, like MPS or continuous matrix Pollack state, you cannot cope with this entanglement. Also, I think that as far as I know, there has not been done a limit to the continuum. So to study the dynamics in one dimensional system, even for short times, and then go and take the limit to the continuum. And so let's think that this is something that's still, I mean, open, but I guess that the tools are there and that shouldn't be that difficult. Okay, so we've moved to two dimensions. Let me just distinguish two cases. I mean, one dimension is, first of all, it's relatively simple because one plus one dimension, one can take matrix Pollack states that are easy to contract. So numerically, they're very friendly. And also you can integrate the gauge degrees of freedom. So at the end, you have a kind of spin model that you have to solve with long range interactions. If you go to two dimensions, that's not so easy. So first of all, you have to distinguish the case of gauge theories and the gauge theories with matter. And it's not possible to integrate the gauge theories of freedom, at least in general. Now, I think that, I mean, people have studied gauge theories with tensor networks already in other contexts for some time ago. For the Torrey code, in a sense, it's a lattice gauge theory, so it has also some local gauge symmetries. But I think that the first work that was done really in thinking about lattice gauge theories beyond Torrey code was done by actually Giffrey and Luca Tagliatocorso and Mera. And I think that this was also the first paper where they realized that you can encode the gauge symmetries in the tensors. And so you don't have to take care about taking general tensors and then project it into the right physical space, but you can just impose that in the tensors. In fact, there were some other papers after that that extend this and then generalize this construction and actually showed how you can gauge degrees of freedom. So for example, you have a theory for matter only for electrons, let's say for fermions, then you know the same way that you gauge, you convert the global symmetries into local symmetries, you can do the same thing in terms of tensor networks. And this allows also, in the spirit of what Luca was doing, to include matter also with the gauge symmetry, just imposing some conditions to the tensors. So at the end, you just choose some kind of tensors, and then you can do the minimization with those systems. So now there have been some recent papers in which now PEPs have been used in order to solve a C3 lattice gauge theory, only gauge field in that case in 2+1 dimensions. That's Daniel Robiner was the main person, and Marie Carmen Bayouz was the main person on that paper, and also a combination of PEPs and Monte Carlo. So that was Eres Toar and Patrick Emmons and Marie Carmen, the main persons on those papers, and the results are very reasonable. So I think that, I mean, you can get, I mean, this for this case, the phase diagram is known as a function of the coupling, and so you recover what is known. There is a phase transition. Now, if you include matter, then there much less works. So there are some places in which toy models have been solved. RSOR and collaborators have done that. And also there is a very interesting paper by Simone Montagnero and collaborators in which they use tensor tree to solve QED systems in 2+1 dimensions. And so that's very promising. As I understand that on Friday, he will be talking about the three-dimensional version of that, which would be the first three-dimensional or 3+1 dimensional calculation using tensor networks. He's using not, let's say, PEPs, but tensor trees. So very curious to know how they work in higher dimensions. And also finer temperature, then so I think the only word that I know is that some people computed the partition function using tensor networks, and it's a different method. It's not minimizing the energy, but just contracting the tensor corresponding to the partition function. And so that's as much as I can say. And also that there are many, many works on 2+1 dimensional theories, and even there are some works on three dimensions with tensor. We will hear more about works that go to 2+1 dimension, including lattice gauge, the gauge fields, abelian and non-abelian, including matter, and hopefully also to three dimensions. But I guess that I'll say more during the Q&A session. Okay, that's it. You're muted.
Thanks. Thank you, Ignacio. Let's move to Brian.
All right. Yeah, thanks. So I'm going to talk about, thanks for having me here. Nice to see you all virtually. I'm going to talk about tensor networks and holography, or tensor networks and quantum gravity, which are not obviously the same thing, quantum gravity and holography, although we think they're closely connected. And I thought first thing I would do is try to give you one idea that, in my opinion, is vague enough to encapsulate most of the activity that is going on, but also still has enough teeth to be a useful source of intuition. And I think I thought about it for a while, and I think that idea is that you should think of space-time as some kind of generalized computational history. And for this purpose, tensor networks are a very natural way to fill out that picture, so to speak, to articulate that, to put that into a framework in which you can discuss different situations. I say generalized history because for a couple of reasons. I mean, the first reason is that it's not often clear whether you should think of this history as sort of living in time or living in space or living in some other way. Early tensor networks were sort of laid down in space in ADS-CFT, but you can also think of them as living in time, and so there's various different points of view. It's also generalized because it doesn't necessarily involve just unitary gates, as in a true quantum circuit or a computation. There could be non-unitary elements, projections, things of this sort. And it's also not clear what all adjectives you should attach to such a history. Maybe it should be a minimal history in some sense, or maybe there's different kinds of histories you can consider, and how they relate to each other is not so clear. You know, preparing in sort of time evolution versus preparing in some kind of RG evolution. These are all different ideas. But like I said, I think it's an idea that's general enough to include most of what goes on and to be a useful source of insight despite that vagueness. Now, then I also wanted to mention just a sampling. This is far from complete, and I'm sorry if I don't mention your paper here, but I mentioned a couple of papers kind of at the frontier, just to give you a sense of where I think things are right now. So the first one I want to mention is called Approximate Bacon Shore Code and Holography by Charles Gao and Brad Lackey that appeared just a month or two ago. This paper is very much pushing the sort of happy code error correction point of view into new regimes, trying to understand how to make sense of the fact that in NADS CFT, ultimately it should be an approximate error correcting code, not an exact error correcting code. And this approximateness should be tied up with the quantum mechanical nature of gravity, with the fact that G Newton is not zero, but just small in the weakly coupled limit. And how to see things like gravitational back reaction, gravitational dressing, the fact that there's no local Hilbert space in the bulk, this kind of stuff. Or let's say that may be too strong, but there's not a precise sense of locality in the bulk. And this paper actually makes a lot of progress on this, essentially using approximate codes, in this case, a Bacon-Shore code as a starting point, which is then deformed or skewed in some way so that you can get a lot of interesting features, including like power law correlations and other things you associate with more realistic models of ADS-CFT or with ADS-CFT itself. The second thing I want to mention is a paper called titled P-Adic CFT as a Holographic Tensor Network. I guess this one is pretty self-explanatory, but basically the idea is here, we changing, this one is by Janet Hung, Wei Li, and Charles Melby Thompson. It appeared in 2019. And here the idea is we're sort of changing the goal. Instead of thinking about ADS-CFT in the continuum, we think about this alternate theory known as P-Adic ADS-CFT. And the nice thing is that theory, it's sort of associated with trees. It has a lot of interesting properties, and it's actually very natural to try to deal with that theory using tensor networks. It's much more natural because there's some additional discreteness in there that matches the discreteness of the tensor network. And it's a very interesting program, which I encourage you to read about. And you can still hope to approach, say, the continuous version of ADS-CFT by some kind of limiting procedure. That's something that people interested in P-Adic ADS-CFT think about. Another paper is called Collision in the Interior of the Wormhole. This is by Ying Zhao just a week or two ago. This is very much trying to interpret more about the, say, complexity story, the idea that if you look at the interior of a black hole, there's a wormhole, or there can be a wormhole, and that wormhole can grow, and that growth is supposedly dual to a growth of complexity. And so this is, again, this idea of computational history. The wormhole is the history of the computation that prepared this state. And you want to interpret in a more precise sense what the various parts of the circuit correspond to in space-time. And Ying has been doing a lot of great work in this area. And in particular, in this recent paper, she proposed some way to think about the region. Well, she proposed a way to think about what happens when parties meet behind the horizon. So how do you think about that in the tensor network and what its interpretation is? And also gave some interesting correspondences between geometrical areas, geometrical measures of that meeting region and the tensor network itself. So I think that's another interesting direction, which, because the interior of the black hole is inherently dynamical, it has a lot of connections to thinking about tensor networks in space-times besides ADS. Let's see, two more. So one is effective entropy of quantum fields coupled with gravity. This is by Shidong, Xiaoling Qi, Zha Shengen, and Zhenbin Yang. Also just a month or two ago, I guess, or maybe over the summer. There's a lot in this paper, but one of the things they do is talk about random tensor network models of general space-times, including closed space-times, and how you should think about these things. So, in this case, the tensor network is not so much a state, but just a number. It's like a fully contracted network, but nevertheless, you can, by sort of breaking that network apart and interpreting the pieces in the right way, try to make contact with what you might call observables in a closed universe, or how to think about closed universe quantum mechanics and gravity. And then the final thing I wanted to mention was a paper called Mera as a Holographic Strange Correlator. I think this appeared recently in under a different name, but it's by Nathan McMahon, Sukhbinder Singh, and Gavin Brennan. And I wanted to mention this one because it touches on a lot of important issues related to symmetries, which of course have an interesting manifestation ADS-CFT in terms of bulk gauge fields. But also I like because it makes contact with the computational side and sort of the real actual model side of things, you know, where you have an actual Hamiltonian on the boundary and you're trying to understand that. And I think this is an important part of the story because as was sort of implicit in the previous two summaries, tensor networks are a very powerful computational tool. And that's something that we haven't used very much in ADS-CFT context yet, but I think we could, and that would be exciting. And yeah, so that's what I wanted to share as a summary. Like I said, this was a small selection of the frontier, motivated partly by the questions that you all submitted. I chose some representative set that addresses those topics. So I think it's a very active field. It's been very fruitful, and I hope to discuss it more with you during the questions.
Okay, fantastic. Thanks, Brian. So to proceed, we decided to select questions, and I'm just going to ask these questions in the rounds and also paste them to the chat so that everybody is up to speed. So let's move to Gifra, and probably Gifra wants to share his screen because he prepared transparencies. And the first question is, what are the advantages and disadvantages of discrete and continuous tensor networks when applied to quantum field theories?
Very good. So yes, so that was the first question that I'm being asked to address. Discrete versus continuous, which one should we be using? So because the computational framework is mostly well developed only for continuous matrix product states in the continuum, I will first say something about specifically about matrix product states. So I would answer these at two levels. First, conceptually, where conceptually is also has computational implications, I would distinguish between whether you want to use tensor networks for a relativistic quantum field theory or a non-relativistic quantum field theory. If what you want is a non-relativistic quantum field theory, then continuous matrix product states are the natural choice in the sense that they are a match for the type of wave functionals, the ground state of this non-relativistic quantum field theory Hamiltonian that you may want to explore. So in particular, you don't have to follow one calculation with another calculation where you try to take a continuum limit or send the ubiquitous off to zero. Instead, if your interest is in a relativistic quantum field theory, then in a sense, you have a choice. Do you want to discretize that theory? So as I mentioned before, when you have a relativistic quantum field theory, there is no ubiquitous. And so in order to use a matrix product state or a continuous matrix product state, you need to introduce a ubiquitous regardless. You can either go to the lattice for that or you can modify the Hamiltonian at short distances. So you have a choice there, and whatever you choose, you're still given a value of this ubiquitous or lattice spacing, then you would need to take the continuum limit by changing the value of this ubiquitous. In terms of algorithms, clearly we have over 20 years of experience, 30 years of experience starting with the MRG on the lattice. So matrix product state algorithms are extremely reliable today. And we may always have surprises, but basically I think that we have very mature algorithms that don't need much changing. The situation is very different for continuous matrix product states. There have been a lot of improvements, and I was actually very pleased to see a recent paper by Benoit Thibens and Jacopo Dinardis and Yuto Hegemann and Frank Verstraete on variational optimization of continuous matrix product states, where this is very recent. It's from June this year, where there is, that might be the latest on algorithms. And the idea is that continuous matrix product state algorithms continue to be improved. They are not as, I wouldn't say they are as good as on the lattice, but they are becoming really useful. Okay, so that was for matrix product states versus continuous matrix product states. And then another important aspect here about continuous tensor networks is that they live in the continuum, and therefore you don't need to break some of the space symmetries that you may have in your original Hamiltonian, the Hamiltonian you want to analyze. And that's important, for instance, translation invariants. If you can keep translation invariants explicitly, that's what you can do in C-Mera. That wasn't possible on the lattice for Mera. Okay, so that's an example. Or imagine rotations in two dimensions or three space dimensions. You can have continuous PEPs, continuous C-Mera, where with rotation invariants, whereas on the lattice, you have to break continuous rotation invariant into a finite subset of rotations. And similarly, in the continuum, you can have these scale transformations made continuous for C-Mera. So that would be my answer.
Super, thanks. So we're moving on to Ignacio. And the question to Ignacio is, what are the prospects for efficient higher dimensional tensor networks for lattice gauge theories?
Okay, so I mentioned already in my previously that I think that in 2+1 dimension, I mean, things are improving, and I see that the prospects are good using simply PEPs. And so I can imagine that there will be now PEPs calculations with bond dimensions of the order of 7 or 8, which are typically enough to describe the systems. For gauge theories, so typically, let's say C3, C4, C5, or some models that have on the bosonic Hilbert space, it has some cutoff at low number, otherwise it gets very difficult. And also including matter and non-abelian fields. So I don't see a big hurdle there. It's similar to what is happening in the context of condensed matter physics, where people are doing 2+1 dimensions also now with PEPs. Now, for higher dimensions, then the situation, it's much harder, and I'm very excited about the results of Simone. I think that we will see if they can do something already in 3+1 dimension. Let me mention a couple other approaches also that I can kind of confident that they would work, but we're working on these things, still fighting with them. So one is a combination of PEPs and Monte Carlo, in which you basically propose a fermionic PEPs, you gauge it, and then you do a variation on the calculation using Monte Carlo. So we did some computations in 2+1 dimension with that, and it turned out that there was a bottleneck, and the bottleneck was something as simple as computing Pfaffians. So it's still, let's say, a scales polynomially with the size of your system, but whenever you wanted to go to bigger systems, then it was a big hurdle. So I think that is probably getting the experience and knowledge from people coming from lattice gauge theory in high energy physics, then this could be improved. And that's a direction that I think is interesting to follow. And the other direction that I think is interesting to follow is going beyond tensor networks and use combination of tensor networks with Gaussian methods or non-Gaussian methods. So it's to take a simple tensor network, and then you put on top of them some Gaussian transformation, and then you minimize with respect to the tensor network and with respect to the parameters of the Gaussian transformation. And it seems that they work very well together. And with that, I think that one can boost some of the methods in 2+1 dimension, maybe in 3 dimensions. But what is important is with that, one can deal also with the continuous groups, not only with C2, C3, you can go to U1 and C2 and so on. Yeah, that's it.
Thank you, Ignacio. Let me just mention that Simona's talk is during the first session on Friday. Okay, very good. So let's move to Brian. And the question to Brian is about what have you learned from tensor network models of holography?
Yeah, great. So I'm going to focus on what we've learned about holography from tensor network models of holography. I mean, there are a lot of things we might have learned, but this is one area that I want to focus on. So I think the first, I want to say a couple of different points, basically. The first is that tensor networks have been a rather clear inspiration, at the very least, an input to a number of important ideas in holography. So one of the first thing that comes to mind is the idea that the growth of the interior of the black hole is related to complexity. And I think it was really the Hartmann-Maltesena paper, followed by Lenny Susskind's work, that brought this to all of our attention. And I'm not sure, you know, I'm sure we would have had some thought of this without tensor networks, but I think they definitely contributed in a very important way to giving us a very simple picture of that physics and a way to interpret it as in terms of a minimal tensor network that prepares that state, which then turned into an idea of complexity. Another example of this kind of contribution is the surface state correspondence, also related to proposals for entanglement purification and what these things mean in gravity. That was all definitely heavily inspired, or at least in part, by tensor networks. So I think there's a lot of directions and proposals in ADS-CFT that have been strongly influenced by tensor networks. And you know, these directions are, of course, unproven. Typically, they're guesses or conjectures, but they have simulated a lot of, I think, valuable research. So we definitely can say we learned something there. Along these lines, but in a sort of different way, tensor networks are also models where you can realize lots of interesting entanglement phenomena. For example, entanglement wedge reconstruction, error correction, related ideas that are all very important in ADS-CFT. And as has been sort of a theme of the recent developments in the ADS-CFT community, the gravitational path integral is sort of a very interesting and special beast. And although ADS-CFT gives you a completely controlled setting in which to think about various things, the gravitational path integral alone, even in flat space or some other kind of space-time, has a lot of interesting information in it. It has a lot of this physics of entropy, error correction, and so forth. And so from that point of view, it's nice to have these tensor network toy models that give similar physics to the gravitational path integral, because the path integral itself, while we know how to analyze it in a semi-classical limit, is mysterious. Defining it properly is a non-trivial task, a highly non-trivial task, which we don't know how to do. And so it's nice to have models that reproduce physics of that path integral in a totally controlled setting, gives us confidence that we're interpreting it correctly and understanding, you know, the lessons it has to teach us. And then the final thing that I'll mention, which is very close to my heart, is that tensor networks provide a way to really translate ideas and results in holography to other settings. So coming back to this idea of complexity growth, you know, that had a very clear holographic interpretation, but once you're thinking about this in a tensor network language, you realize, okay, well, this will actually apply pretty generally to sort of any system. So it starts to prompt us to ask questions about, in a new way, you know, what's really special about ADS-CFT? Is there a way to interpret sort of any quantum system, or at least any chaotic quantum system, using this kind of language, perhaps through the lens of tensor networks? And so I think that's also a very important direction and set of lessons that we've been learning thanks to tensor networks. So that's my response to that question.
Perfect, Brian. Moving on, let's go to Gifra. And the question to Gifra is, what are the prospects for CIMERA for interacting quantum field theories?
Okay, there we are. So what are the prospects for CIMERA for interacting quantum field theories? I think that's a spot on question. So let's remember that on the lattice, we have both a variational class of wave functions, which is given by this two-dimensional array of tensors, together with an efficient computation, the efficient computation of observables. So we, given a choice of variational parameters here, we will be able to compute expectation values of local observables. And then on the lattice still, a meta optimization algorithm takes as an input a Hamiltonian, possibly interacting Hamiltonian, typically interacting Hamiltonian, and then produces an output, as an output, an optimized pair of tensors or all these tensors, and then from there we can extract information. So let's go to the continuum for CIMERA. That question is for CIMERA. And here what the first thing we need to emphasize, or at least remind ourselves of, is that in this case, we have, instead of discrete tensors, we have a continuous evolution in scale which I'm going to assume is a scale invariant for simplicity, that is generated by two generators. One is a scale transformation L, and the other one is the one that contains all the variational parameters. It's known as Untangler. It's the responsible for mixing the degrees of freedom in a quasi-local way. So basically, specifying a C-meta boils down to specifying this quasi-local entangling density, which I describe as K of X, but as I'm emphasizing, is quasi-local, so you can imagine something with a characteristic length scale there. Very good. So what would it mean for to have a C-meta algorithm for interacting quantum field theories? Well, the formalism, as I mentioned before, was already presented in the initial paper on C-meta. So the formalism was described both for free and interacting theories. The difference between free theories and interacting theories would be whether K is quadratic in the fields or contains quartic terms, say, or beyond quadratic terms. And so for a free theory, you can use a quadratic entangling density, which results in a Gaussian wave function. For an interacting theory, you would want to use something which is not quadratic, resulting in a non-Gaussian wave function. Very good. So the formalism is there. How about an efficient computational framework? For free theories, all we need was the first formulation. The original paper came with explicit examples how to deal with free bosons, free fermions, and so on. And then since then, over the years, there have been a number of proposals. I wanted to collect two of those, or at least I group some of the papers into two categories. One is to go beyond free quantum field theories by going beyond a Gaussian wave function, just perturbatively away. The other one, and so there are a number of papers I collected with Jordan Cutler, Javier Molina Villaplana, some of the authors. And then another version is still sticking with a free Gaussian wave functional. You can dress it through a canonical transformation, which will not change the decay of correlations and so on, but you can dress it so that it is not a Gaussian wave function anymore. But the big question of can we deal with an interacting quantum field theory in a similar way that we can deal with an interacting lattice model in full generality with some degree of difficulty that depends on the entanglement in the wave functional as opposed to how close you are from a free Hamiltonian and so on, that is still an open question. Okay, that's all I had to say.
Thanks, Gifra. So the next question goes to Ignacio. It's a long question that starts with pathway towards tensor network study of QCD. What steps, aside from method improvements, should be undertaken? That is, which models should be studied in 1 plus 1 and 2 plus 1 dimensions? What questions should be asked?
Okay, so I'm not an expert on quantum chromodynamics, so I don't know, actually. So, I mean, I guess that there is a path that, I mean, just solve more and more difficult problems, add some ingredients and go in that direction. I will concentrate on the last part of the question, which is what questions should be asked. And I think that that's the way I see tensor network is not only as a tool of solving, I mean, numerical methods, it's more that it gives us a picture of how to describe physical systems. And I mean, Brian was already mentioning, so how this can help to teach us about holography, but I think that it can teach us in lattice gate theory and other fields. And we have seen that in the context of condensed matter physics and also quantum optics and quantum information. And I think that something similar can happen in the field of lattice gate theories, namely that it opens up for new questions that people didn't ask in the past and allows us to look at with a different perspective to those systems. I mean, people have studied with tensor networks or started studying with tensor networks in condensed matter physics, for instance, SPT phases. So, I mean, one can think, so what is the SPT phases for lattice gate theories? Now, yeah, more elaborated symmetries. I know that there are some works on that, but this could give a complete classification in which you don't have to do numerical calculations, but at the end it's a classification of tensors. The classification of tensors tells you classification of all possible theories that you can have. And in a sense, what they tell you is that you will do some kind of renormalization and you look at the fixed points, at least for some phases, then you could just look at this tensor and classify all possible fixed points just by them. Or also, I was giving a talk about circuits and quantum cellular automata. So now, how can you encode in circuits lattice gauge theories for dynamics? So these are discretization in time. So is there a way of just writing lattice gauge theories, not in terms of action or Hamiltonian or something like that, but in terms of circuits that can be run right away in the one of these NISQ devices? Or also, I mean, tensor networks can come, like Brian knows very well, with a ball boundary correspondence for free. So you just write a tensor network and automatically the degrees of freedom, maximum degrees of freedom of the boundary gives you boundary theory, explains area law and so on, and this can be exploited. So what about lattice gauge theory? People have also, I mean, tensor networks have close connections with entanglement, and so people have studied now entanglement in lattice gauge theories. Also think in terms of tensor networks, so what happens now with kind of the gauge symmetry? So how do they affect entanglement? So also about efficient representation. So can one prove that all lattice gauge theories, at least in some limit, can be efficiently described in terms of MERA or in tensor networks or something? I mean, without having to compute, just to say that then you can formulate a lattice gauge series just in terms of tensor, not in terms of a Lagrangian. And there are many questions that come up, and I think that that's very interesting, that it is not only a tool to solve problems, but it's a tool to ask new questions that can shed light and open up the new directions.
Thank you very much, Ignacio. So let's move to Brian. And the question to Brian is about the role of a large number of colors / large set of charge in holographic tensor networks.
Yeah. So I think coming back a little bit to this idea of space time as a generalized computational history, you can typically view the tensor network as some kind of generalized discretized path integral, essentially, or partition function. And from this point of view, from that point of view, as just a generalized partition function, large N serves a usual kind of role of enabling you to control the theory by looking at saddle points of this generalized partition function. So it fulfills a technical role. And then because we understand ADS CFT best in the case where N is large, it's natural to, you know, try to incorporate this simplifying feature into our tensor networks. That being said, I don't necessarily think that large N is it's used for computational aid, like in random tensor networks, it enables you to deal with the sort of spin problem that you get to compute the purity, for example, in a nice way. But I don't think that the large N structure particularly closely matches the way large N appears in ADS CFT yet, you know, in terms of particular matrix degrees of freedom, for example. In fact, even, you know, something like SYK or these tensor models, we don't have a very nice tensor network picture for how to think about those states. I mean, there's no geometric locality there. So you have to think sort of within, it's this old problem that we confronted for a long time, which is how to think about sub ADS locality in tensor networks. It sort of requires you to look inside the tensors of the MERA, at least that was the old idea. And there's no geometrical structure there that's obvious. And so it's kind of a hard terrain to navigate, so to speak. So we don't have a very good handle on that. So I think it's a useful tool at this stage, but it's not that closely mimicking what you see in ADS CFT. And then the other thing I wanted to mention is that it should, finite and large finite end should be associated with some deep pieces of physics in the bulk. So the gravitational back reaction, gravitational dressing, meaning the need to define your bulk observables in a gauge invariant way. And this is also something I think we don't yet have a super deep understanding of in tensor networks. You know, roughly speaking, what I'd like to see is to know what are the right features or set of questions that you should ask or have in your tensor network in order to have these properties. You know, what in the tensor network corresponds to gravitational dressing? And I think we just don't quite have a very succinct answer to that question yet. This paper I mentioned from Charles and Brad about proximate codes and holography is making some interesting progress in this direction, in my opinion. They do have sort of notions of back reaction where like the code subspace that you're thinking about depends on the presence or absence of bulk matter or the bulk matter state. So there's hints, but I think there's still a lot to understand there. So I think it has this clear, just simplifying computational rule, but then a lot of the connection to the deeper parts of ADS-CFT and also to the concrete ADS-CFT models is still lacking. So that's a big area for development.
Thanks, Brian. So this is the last part of the meeting for today, but when contacting the panelists, we said that that's gonna last only like till about now. And the question to you, to three of you, is if you can stay for about like 15 minutes longer to answer some more questions.
Yeah, my next meeting is not full 30 more minutes, so I have 30 minutes.
Mine is in 15 minutes, actually. So I postponed it for 9:15 European time. So I have to stop in 10 minutes, basically. Yeah.
Okay, very good. And how about you, Giffrey?
So, Michał, I have 3 minutes left.
Okay. Good. So, in lieu of time, let's move to Giffra. And the question to Giffra is about truncated Hamiltonian methods in the context of tensor networks and quantum field theory. Are there common lessons to be learned?
Yeah. Okay. Great. So, this is my favorite question. I have no idea how to answer it, but I decided to tell you that, well, you all know about tensor networks, and this is one of the defining features, is that it's a real space approach where you start with the real space degrees of freedom and figure out how to describe the wave function. And then on the other hand, Hamiltonian truncation methods, they are essentially living in momentum space. You can say more than just that, but that's a starting point. So what are these Hamiltonian truncation methods or truncated Hamiltonian methods? So you start with a Hamiltonian that you would like to describe or you would like to understand the low energy physics of. And then suppose that this Hamiltonian is a sum of two terms. The first term is an easy quantum field theory Hamiltonian. It's easy because it's free or integrable or it's a solvable CFT. So you have a way of finding analyzing it, finding the eigenvectors and eigenvalues. And then on top of that, the Hamiltonian that you are interested in is this easy Hamiltonian and some additional interaction, some additional terms. And the idea is simple. You build the low energy SAT space for H0, the part that you know how to deionalize. You just deionalize it for at low energies. And then you compute the matrix elements for this other part of the Hamiltonian. So if you can do that, then what you do is you build H at low energies in that basis. And so suddenly H is nothing, in that basis is nothing but the finite dimensional matrix, and you take it from there. So that's either Hamiltonian truncation or my understanding, my poor understanding of how that works. In any case, how do you want to learn common lessons from that? I'm not sure how to answer this. Maybe the person who asked the question had something in mind and they want to explain it. One thing that came to my mind is that we are, for instance, with on the circle with matrix product states on the circle, we can actually build the low energy SAT space, and Yi and Zhou will give a talk on this later this week, on how to use periodic matrix product states on to deionalize CFTs by starting from the lattice, from a critical spin chain, and recover all the conformal data out of it. And so that would be a connection there. similarity. And also, it might be possible to use ideas from continuous meta to maybe apply some renormalization group transformation and modify the additional interactions before you actually. So you could imagine having the understanding how to use the disentangler the entangler and for H0 and apply it to V in a way that simplifies V a little bit. But that's all I could come up with. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Pietro. So the second last point is a question to Ignacio. Question about what is the status and prospects for tensor-network representation of non-abelian gauge theories with fermionic matter?
So this question has two names in it. So one is non-abelian gauge theories, and the other one is fermionic matter. And so I guess that this refers, compared to abelian gauge theories and maybe tensor networks where there is no fermionic matter. So actually, as far as I know, the fact that you have a non-abelian gauge theory doesn't make much more difficult the tensor network calculations. What makes it more difficult is that these gauge groups are continuous typically, and that's hard for tensor network methods. So this is why you have to discretize. And when you discretize, you typically would like to go and increase the representations, so the representation space of your group until you go to the continuum. Like if you have U1 symmetry, you would like to go maybe to C2, then C3, then C5, and then you think that in this way you can approach the limit. For non-abelian groups, I mean, sometimes that's not so obvious. Okay, you have SU2, so where do you embed it? You can put a platonic solid with the symmetries of a platonic solid, but there are a finite number of them. But still, there are methods of doing that, maybe not based on platonic solids. So I don't think that, I mean, that's a big problem. So I would say that as far as I understand, there shouldn't be, I mean, we know that there are ways of representing in your tensors both abelian gauge and non-abelian gauge theories, and it's just some properties that your tensor has to fulfill. Now, with respect to fermionic matter, I would say that this is not a problem either. So tensor networks have the advantage that they don't care about fermions or bosons, so they are the same, treated in a very similar way. So there is no sign problem. So the question here is only that you have more degrees of freedom. You have the gauge fields and the fermionic degrees of freedom, and this makes the computations more difficult. But still, I think that this is, I mean, a kind of polynomial. I mean, you will get the factor more difficult. So it would be 10 times more difficult than without matter, or maybe 20 times more difficult. It takes 20 times longer in your cluster. But that's I don't see a problem either here. So the problem is how to go to higher dimensions. 2+1, I say that's really, I mean, seems feasible with reasonable bond dimensions and with using tricks that people have developed in condensed matter physics. I think that this could be done. I mean, the difference is that in lattice gauge theory, you have plaquette terms, and these plaquette terms also are computationally costly, but there are tricks around. So we develop also Marie-Carmen Banyuls and collaborators develop some methods in order just to, I mean, treat these plaquette terms like, I mean, two-body interactions. So, I mean, at the end, you can use even the code, the PEPS code for condensed matter physics for those systems directly. But going to 3+1, it's an issue. You know that there is this famous scaling, this infamous scaling of the computational time with the bond dimension. In two dimension, naively, is this d is the bond dimension, d to the power 10, d to the power 12. In three dimension, is d to the power 18. So that's very tough. Even having a bond dimension two computation in 3+1 dimension is very tough. But that's why ideas that simplify the tensor networks or combine with Monte Carlo is where there is a chance. Otherwise, I guess it will be very difficult, unless there is a breakthrough that somebody figures out ways of computing, of contracting tensors in higher dimensions that work well for the specific models that we want to treat. Because one has to say that in general, contracting tensors, even in two dimensions, contracting PEPS is a sharp field. pretty hard problem. So, I mean, you give your tensor until you contract it, you won't be able to get it. And it's basically impossible in practice if it's big enough. So it has to, one has to use the special properties of lattice gauge theory, like the symmetries or the fact that you have translational invariance, rotational invariance, or whatever it is, I think that has to be used for that.
Okay, super. Thanks, Ignacio. And the last question in the session goes to Brian, and it's about the leading ideas for extending holographic picture in ADSEs using error correction, happy codes, tensor networks to other spacetimes, for example, the sitter.
Yeah, okay. So there's, I'll just mention two things here. So there's definitely like just a very direct extension where you say, okay, this tensor network looks like a spatial slice of ADS. Well, I can make a tensor network that looks like a causal patch of de Sitter or in general, whatever kind of spacetime you want, or at least within some class. In this context, there's been a lot of questions in the community about whether, you know, going back to the original Mera ADS kind of idea, you know, is Mera a spatial slice? Is it actually de Sitter space because it has its causal structure? Is it something else? There's various proposals in the literature. From this point of view, I think an important thing to be aware of is the work that Giffre and Glenn did, where they really discussed, Ash, not Glenn, I think, and Ash Milstead, where they really discussed the causal structure of these tensor networks. And how to think about that, how to define it, and how to answer the question, given some tensor network, what is the causal structure of that thing, and how to interpret it in terms of a space-time. So the sort of kinematical tools are there. We know how to like make tensor networks look like different kinds of space-times. That structure is there. But I think there is another side of this, which is, you know, how to really match to the to the features of quantum gravity in these other spacetimes. So for example, in a spacetime with a different kind of asymptotic structure, the observables you have in that spacetime are very different than the observables you have in ADS CFT. In particular, in a closed universe, it's sort of not clear what the observables are at all and how to even think about that. From this point of view, I think the idea of islands comes into the story. And because, you know, these tell us, again, touching back to this idea I mentioned about viewing space-time as a computational history, these tell us that, you know, one way you can interpret closed space-time in some situations is as really preparing states of some auxiliary degrees of freedom that live somewhere else. It's like this space-time is describing an entangled state of some other degrees of freedom, which are kind of entangled with the degrees of freedom in this closed space-time. So it's really like representing a state preparation of something that's entangled with your system. And from this point of view, then you need these other ancilla degrees of freedom to sort of probe or make sense of, or have some question you can ask about the physics of this closed space-time. And to go back to the papers I mentioned, this is kind of thing which is discussed a little bit in this paper on effective entropy of quantum fields coupled with gravity. They, in their tensor network model, talk a fair bit about tensor networks representations of closed space times and how you maybe need some ancilla degrees of freedom or some other kind of handhold to make sense of what those space times are trying to tell you and how to interpret them. So just to summarize, I think that the sort of tools are there and there are early ideas for how to interpret these things, but I think still very, very early days at this point from my point of view.
Okay, thanks, Brian. I guess that's like the good breaking point to finish the discussion. I mean, we ran a bit out of time. I guess I should also thank Ignacio and Giffre, who actually had to leave. One thing that I want to point out is that we have Remo, and we also have the Slack channel, and part of the discussion can be continued. There. Also, if you have some suggestions for how the discussion session should look like on Friday, I guess you can also convey them, and we'll try to adopt to good ideas. So thanks all for joining, and I hope to see you any of you tomorrow, basically midday for us and morning for America. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Yuhan.
Thanks. See ya.
Thank you.